Welcome to the Boardroom Governance Podcast. I'm your host, Evan Epstein. This is a very special episode. We have reached the 100th episode of the podcast, which is quite the milestone. I've been hosting this podcast for over 3 years now. It all started as a pandemic project from my home office in May of 2020. I've covered every detail of this pod from A to Z. I'm the host, editor, producer, and everything in between. From picking the hosting website, podcast outlets, interviewing platform, editing software, audio post-production software, it's been a full podcasting journey. After 100 episodes, I can say that I've learned quite a lot in this process. First off, I'm very grateful for the over 100 guests of this pod who have taken the time to talk to me about their personal and professional experiences. I believe we have all collectively learned a lot more about corporate governance through these conversations, and I look forward to the next 100 episodes. I'm also very happy to say that this podcast has been selected as the best, or at least among the top, corporate governance podcasts. In fact, if you want to learn in a long-form interview format about board matters from some of the leading scholars, practitioners, directors, and investors, you'd be hard-pressed to find a better podcast than this one. But a high-quality podcast requires significant investment of time and resources. For this purpose, I've created a new Patreon site at patreon.com/boardroomgovernancepod. Again, that's patreon.com/boardroomgovernancepod. Any support that you can provide to maintain and improve the quality and quantity of this podcast is greatly appreciated. Join my corporate governance community to help make these discussions possible. Okay, now let's talk about this special 100th anniversary episode. In this podcast, I talk with Leo E. Strine Jr., currently of counsel at Wachtell Lipton Rosen & Katz. Prior to joining the firm, he was the Chief Justice of the Delaware Supreme Court from early 2014 through late 2019. Before becoming the Chief Justice, he served on the Delaware Chancery Court as Chancellor since June 2011 and as Vice Chancellor since November of 1998. In his judicial positions, Mr. Strine wrote hundreds of opinions in the areas of corporate law, contract law, trust and estates, criminal law, administrative law, and constitutional law. Mr. Strine speaks and writes frequently on the subjects of corporate and public law, and particularly the impact of business on society. In this episode, we talk about his personal and professional background, the Delaware Chancery Court, and his latest article, Good Corporate Citizenship We Can All Get Behind, Toward a Principled, Non-Ideological Approach to Making Money the Right Way, published in the Business Lawyer, Spring 2023 edition. We also discuss ESG matters, stockholder primacy versus stakeholder governance frameworks, the increasing politicization and polarization of corporate governance, and the role of institutional investors in the story. If you like the show, please consider subscribing, leaving a review, or sharing this podcast on social media. You can also now contribute as a patron on the new link patreon.com/boardroomgovernancepod, and you can also subscribe to the Boardroom Governance newsletter at evanepstein.substack.com. Leo, it is such an honor and pleasure to have you in the Boardroom Governance Podcast. It's the 100th episode, so it's a very special episode for me and for all the listeners. It's been 2 years since the pandemic, and here we are. We have you on the podcast to talk about corporate governance, and I'm very happy, and it's a huge honor to have you.
It's great to be here, and it's appropriate that it's the 100th anniversary because I've worked at three places in my career, Evan. Skadden, Wilmington, actually with Governor Carper and the Delaware Court of Chancery and now Wachtell, where every year is such that I'm actually coming up on my 100th birthday.
It's dog years, I suppose.
In ordinary life, I'd be 59, but I actually feel like and look like I am a centenarian.
You double at the count. Okay. That's clearly not the case. I'm seeing you now and you're totally fine. But with all my guests, I've done something that is start with the origin story of the guest so that people can learn more from them. And I think everyone brings something different. Why don't we start with you? Tell us where you're born, where you grew up, and we'll move from there. And you have a long career, but maybe we'll try to keep it under 10 minutes.
No, it's actually, I'll tell you, Evan, one of the few times where I ever kind of feel obliged to correct somebody if they introduce me, and I won't need to correct you because of the way you've done the introduction, is when they would introduce me as a Delaware native, because I'm proud to have grown up in Delaware since I was nine, but I was actually born to row home kids in Baltimore. My parents and all my grandparents were from Baltimore, and that is a place that's dear to me. And you know, but I grew up in the state of Delaware, and I actually met my wife in high school, AI High School in Greenville, Delaware. But I grew up in a town called Hocassin, and I still live there right now.
Okay, and so tell us more about all the way after law school and your start of your legal career.
Well, you know, the only course in corporate law I took in law school, Evan, was corporations. Mm-hmm. And I actually think that's because it was a better time in law school education when it was expected that you take a broad array of survey courses, and those remain the most important things because that's how you acquire breadth and depth in the tradition of law and are able to spot issues. But my passion was public service. And to the extent that I really took deeper courses, it tended to be in constitutional law and civil procedure. And I clerked for two federal judges, but my intention really was a career in public service. And in fact, I went to law school under a great misimpression. I mean, I was choosing between going to graduate school in political science, which was a passion of mine. I love philosophy, political science, history, and literature. But I thought that if I went to PhD school, I would just be writing term papers for the rest of my life. And that if I went into law school, I could act on the world and be more effective. Half of that was kind of right, but I can't imagine a profession where you write more, as you know, than in the law. But I actually, you know, I ended up in corporate law kind of serendipitously because Delaware, you know, that's one of our leading industries. I was, when I came out of my clerkships, I had an offer from the Justice Department in D.C. to be an assistant U.S. attorney. I was very interested in them. But I had the great good fortune to become associated with Delaware's congressman. And I was asked to represent his campaign. And he was going to be, if he elected, the first Democratic governor in Delaware for 16 years. If I wanted to work on the campaign and represent the campaign, I couldn't be a federal prosecutor. It would be unethical. And I had summered at this great office in Wilmington of Skadden. And one of the things I grasped, Evan, and you'll get this, is I loved political science. I loved the structure of power. And I kind of immediately grasped the analogies between Republican democracy and direct democracy and how a corporate law works. And so I ended up at Skadden for between 2 and 3 years while I was simultaneously serving as counsel and one of the policy people on the Carper for Governor committee. And so as an interesting thing, Delaware is a special, you know, it's a small state. And I was able to get involved as a young person very much in, you know, I was president of College Democrats, got to intern for Governor Carper. I spent my summers in law school, actually, mostly in the attorney general's office on Capitol Hill. And I only summered in a big law firm. And it was Skadden was the summer before my first clerkship because I needed to make some money, honestly.
And it was also an important time in corporate law, particularly in Delaware, right?
Oh, and particularly at SCAD Wilmington.
Right.
I mean, I actually shared an office my summer with a person who became basically a lifelong friend, Andy Bouchard, who was a fellow Truman Scholar, deeply involved in our community. And Rod Ward, a dear person to me and leader of the office, put me in the a shared office with Andy because of our shared commitment to public service in the community. And in that year in Skadden, cases like Interco, Apple Bancorp were going on. You know, it was the height of the takeover era, and that office was three quarters litigators. That's why it was, you know, people forget that was the first office of Skadden outside of New York. And it was because of Delaware's role in that. And so it was an exciting place to be with a truly special group of people, including some people you know from academia. For example, my good friend, you may have heard of Randall Thomas, the distinguished professor at Vanderbilt. Mm-hmm. I worked on a pro bono case with Randall that summer to the Delaware Supreme Court where he argued. And so there was a special talent pool that came through that office. I mean, you know, because we were an academic, people like Gordon Smith, mm-hmm. Adam Pritchard, both of them at SCAD in Wilmington. Grant and Eisenhofer heard of that law firm. Both of those associates mm-hmm. at SCAD in Wilmington. Justice Valahura, Vice Chancellor Lamb. It just was a special office. And so that summer of 88, I mean, it really was exciting for me. And after my clerkship, and because of this serendipity of, frankly, Congressman Carper's run, you know, that's where I started my legal career after my clerkships.
Okay. And then obviously you joined the Chancery Court in 98, and you had a long tenure both in the Chancery Court and then the Delaware Supreme Court. So tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I mean, that's, again, a sort of blur, right? But I mean, I will always kind of sort of think of myself as a chancery person just because it's such a special place. And the close-knit nature of the judges, the fact that you decide the cases yourself, but your colleagues are really full partners. And my chancellor when I came in was Bill Chandler, someone I had the greatest respect for. I was with Steve Lamb and Jack Jacobs and Myron Steele and others who came along, like, you know, Sam Glasscock, who I love, and people, you know, amazing judges who are still on the court. You know, and I got to see folks like Vice Chancellor Laster. I got to see him flourish as a practitioner and then become a colleague. And you know, in the Supreme Court, I got to serve along with someone like Justice Holland, who I looked up to as a young lawyer. And I'm probably omitting people, but, you know, being a judge is a special thing. And I clerked for two wonderful judges. And so that public trust is, and feeling of responsibility is one that, you know, I took very seriously. And chancery in particular, you have to really deliver results in real time. And the scrutiny we get, not just from practitioners, but from, as you know, academics, is intense. And it's also internationally influential. And my time on Chancery in the Supreme Court, but Chancery in particular, and the connections that my mentor, Bill Allen, sort of forged and people sure. like me tried to build upon, where we reached out to the world and really interacted with our stakeholders. You know, I was able to develop a lot of lasting relationships around the world that have been personally meaningful to me. And frankly, during the World Cup, my legal friends and I from places like the Amsterdam and Rio de Janeiro, we and London, we email each other about our favorite game. But we all kind of met through this fact that, you know, there is a corporate law and business law community writ large, and Delaware is at the center of it. And so I was able, I kind of never got to do like sort of my initial dream of going to Washington because I committed myself to Delaware, but it's also because of our niche in a very important segment of law. It's one that reaches far beyond our borders and is quite interactive, not just with pretty much people in every state of the U.S., but really in every region of the globe.
Yeah, and obviously it's a hugely influential court and state in corporate law. Also, maybe what are your thoughts in terms of its evolution, right? Like from when you started in 98 to now, it's expanded, there's more judges, but any change or does it remain the course and how do you see that?
I think my colleagues know I'm ambivalent about the expansion of the number of judges because I do think the communication among the judges is incredibly important, but I understand the growth in the caseload and the demands. I think one of the special things about Chancery is the hands-on nature of the judges, managing their own discovery, talking to each other, listening, being cautious about overreaching, recognizing that the case-by-case approach is important, and trying to keep the color gray in mind, be very vigilant about policing the duty of loyalty, but be very careful about, you know, making snap judgments. I think that core is still there. I think the dependability and reliability of the court, the speed with which it's worked, you know, like during the pandemic proved out again, the results in deal break cases when people opportunistically tried to, you know, basically turn their back on the word because of the pandemic, when they really didn't have a contractually proper reason to withdraw, the outcomes were different in Delaware than in places where the cases weren't in Delaware, because the Court of Chancery made itself available in real time during the emergency. And that was incredibly important. And I think the commitment that both levels have is this the secret, that with the responsiveness of our General Assembly and governors in coordination with the bar to keep the corporate law updated. And it's also the commitment of our bar. What I said, Evan, about our interactiveness is people in Delaware listen all the time. They really care. And they really care about integrity. And that's why, as you know, when you look at the scholarship, I always say, I'd love to everybody to take all 49 other states and sum up all the remedies they've given over time to vindicate stockholders when there's been a breach of fiduciary duty. And I'd like to stack them against the little state of Delaware, because the race to the bottom, whatever the race is, we're not the bottom. If we may be racing, but we set a higher fiduciary standard in Delaware than any other state in the nation. And that's brought to life by the combination of our courts, the fact that the statute writers do care about integrity, and to give credit, the symbiosis between Delaware and the Securities and Exchange Commission. Because, you know, that interactive nature, you know, Evan, of the disclosure regime under the SEC is what really brings to life these things. And so, you know, there's a lot of reasons why you can criticize any particular case. But the commitment to do it right, to listen, to be impartial, there's no hometown. In fact, the DuPont company used to get always beat up in Delaware, almost to prove that we wouldn't hometown anybody. That's special. And the fact that we have a nonpartisan judiciary selected on the basis of merits. You may disagree with the decision about the Delaware Supreme Court or a chance. It never comes down in Delaware, Evan, to whether someone was a Republican or Democrat. You know, in fact, when we struck down the death penalty in Delaware, the only dissenter was a Democrat. And, you know, Republicans were in the majority to strike it down. And I'm not criticizing the one with dissent. I wrote the lead opinion, and that's probably my proudest part of being Chief Justice. But what I'm saying is the cases in Delaware, you know, you never hear about corporate law in Delaware being infected in any way by partisanship. And actually, that's true in criminal and constitutional law. And so that's a trust that those of us who are privileged to wear the robe take seriously. And it's our brand, and it's everything that it's that's the thing that is most essential in our state. And in fact, many of the judges, we've been the ones who sometimes in areas like alternative entities or trust and estates have often with our corporate bar been one saying, don't go where other states are going. This, we're special. Our brand is everything. And our brand is, it is integrity and a commitment to protecting the vulnerable and to making sure people live up to their fiduciary obligations.
Yeah, now that's a really interesting insights into Delaware and its Chancery Court. And
Evan, I just want to say a point of privilege about Delaware. It just maddens me when people say that it's a place for, it's a tax haven. One, you know, in the U.S. system, you can't really use states to thing. That's not how it works, right? And our corporate franchise taxes in Delaware are actually the highest in the nation. We can't make tax revenue by not charging taxes. And there's a reason it was called the Panama Papers and not the Delaware Papers. And the thing I always point out to people is you can criticize a lot of Delaware corporations. And one of the great reasons you can criticize them is you know more about Delaware corporations than any other corporations on earth. I was on a train car and some guide from the UK, and I finally had to stand up and say something. First, he was making him erroneous information about how close the Jersey Shore was from Trenton and all this kind of stuff. Listen, then he said, we're going to go into Delaware, and that's a place where secret corporations can form. And I stood up and I said, you know, sir, I've heard a lot of this. I'm actually the chancellor of the Delaware Court of Chancery. And I said, how many of you have heard of Conrad Black? And it all hurt because he's not famous really in the U.S. I mean, I know he wouldn't like to hear that, but he's not as famous in the U.S. as he was in the U.K. And he's the proprietor of the Telegraph. Mm-hmm. He was. And even though the company that owned the Telegraph, he only owned a minority of the equity. He had a majority of the thing. And I had a famous case involving him. And I said, if you've heard of him, I said, you've heard of that because he used a Delaware corporation. And it was a public corporation. And people brought claim for fiduciary duty based on public filings about it. And you may have read about that in the newspaper. I'm like, yeah. And I said, have you heard of companies like, at that time, it hadn't changed the name, Google, General Motors, Walmart, Apple? Oh, yeah, we've heard of them. And they're really secret, right? No, they're not secret. I'm like, yeah, they're the Delaware corporations. I said, you know a lot about us. You may not like us, but it's not a place, it's not a tax haven like Jersey or, you know, I always think, you know, the world's famous Dutch rock band is actually from Ireland. And they did a song called Bloody Sunday. I said, we're not a tax haven. It's just not what we do. You may not like what we do, but what we do has integrity. And frankly, we do charge a pretty hefty tax rate for it because that is part of how we get revenue as a state. And what we provide for it, Evan, is that the fiduciary protection, the constant updating of the law, the reliability of the law. And so we actually, as a state, have really tried to be a leader in disclosure about entities and small entities because we don't like people to try to use our, you know, the Delaware name in an improper way, because it's really, really contrary to our self-interest. And it's also contrary to our belief system about how we perceive ourselves as a state. And we try to market ourselves and say, if you want to be a high quality business and you want to operate with integrity and reliability and you want to make money the right way, then we are the state to incorporate in. But don't, if you want to go be, you know, to be honest, have no fiduciary responsibility, no accountability, we would kind of prefer you go elsewhere.
Yeah. And there's one prominent company that is flirted with Nevada, but let's hold that.
Oh, no, no, I get that. And yeah. You know, Godspeed. Yeah. Same thing with inversions. I mean, when you're mm-hmm. willing to abandon your own nation so as not to pay taxes, we don't gate that. We do not try in any way to impede the flow of capital. That's up to investors. And that's one thing, you know, one of my friends, a professor, Mark Rowe at Harvard, who you know, mm-hmm. Mark was taken. He studied this, Evan, about how dynamic the stock, you know, the company bases of Delaware. And I said to him, well, that's because, you know, honestly, we really don't impede anyone from leaving. It really is a matter of voluntary choice. And we're vulnerable if if people want to invert or they want to merge out of Delaware. And if stockholders decide it's not a place where they trust having their capital, they can leave. That's not our game. We're not trying to, you know, lure people here and then keep them. We stay on our toes because we know that if you're actually going to commit to a market system, you know, you have to be competitive. And where we try to be competitive is in the, you know, the ways I think we think are fundamentally important, which is to have, you know, a really sensible corporate law with a high level of fiduciary integrity. But that also recognizes that, you know, if you punish business people for making good faith business mistakes, that's just not sound. And I always point out to young people, they drink a lot of products, even a funny sounding water called Dasani from one of the world's most successful corporations. They had, when I was a kid, one of the worst product rollouts of all time. And it's not because they didn't study it, but they rolled out the new Coke famously. And the new Coke mm-hmm. did not do well. Now, you don't want to punish people for that. That's what the business judgment rule is about, right? And it's a dynamic world. People make mistakes. What Delaware is you look at whether people are trying to act impartially. You try to encourage good behavior, safeguards to shift power to impartial independent directors if there's a conflict of interest, and to allow the disinterested stockholders themselves to have the high hand. And by that way, you create, I think, you know, it's always going to be case by case problems, right? I mean, but overall the system is a high one of integrity. And internationally, as you know, one of the things that really it is the success of the American system writ large, the combination of state corporate law and the SEC, is the level of outright kind of insider, you know, self-dealing and fraud is just trivial in the United States in comparison to many international markets. And that makes this a place where people feel they can safely invest. And that creates the capital that allows for growth and you hope for jobs and continuing economic prosperity for our nation.
Mm. One of the things that you said is really interesting, and it's the politics of it, right? And of Chancery. And this brings us to one of your latest papers, which is really about the mantra of the day, which is ESG, environmental social governance. And so now you've written a paper on good corporate citizenship and toward a principled, non-ideological approach to making money the right way. So why don't you tell us what prompted you to write this, and then we'll dig into some of these issues that you have uncovered in your paper.
Well, you know, Evan, as I mentioned before, my life has been animated by a commitment to public service. And really, you know, my heroes are people like Franklin Roosevelt, Martin Luther King, George Orwell, folks who were committed to certain ideals about liberty and equality and what a genuinely equitable society was about. And so as I've approached looking at corporate governance, I've always tried to keep an eye on the big picture and what were the results of it. And when I was on the bench, as you know, I've written a lot of academic articles all the time I was a judge, and a lot of them have been about the larger impact of corporations on society and societal fairness, and whether corporations, for example, treat their workers as well as they should. And, you know, the old words for ESG, as you know, were corporate social responsibility, but this is not a new debate. Mm-hmm. And ESG is, I think, in some ways, a proxy for good corporate citizenship. And I think it actually betrays its limitations as a name because, Evan, as you may know, I say it should be double ESG because somebody told me that I kept asking where the workers are, and they told me very aptly that they were buried in the S. And there's a double entendre there, and I thought that was quite appropriate. But really, ESG is about, in my sense of it, is making money the right way. But the definitional question has gotten hot and heavy, right? There's been, in the last 10 years, been a growing recognition that corporations have not been as environmentally responsible as they should be, and that there's a big connection between things like climate change and other forms of pollution to corporate activity. There have been great consumer harms that have harmed communities, the opioid crisis, other sorts of things. We've had the destabilization of the economy through, you know, overreaching in the financial sector. And we've had growing inequality because of not as good treatment of workers. And so there's been this pressure growing for corporations to be more responsible. But what does corporate responsibility mean? And what we've also seen is corporations, instead of focusing things on the control, getting more involved in situationally when there are things that are real things for society. I mean, I'm not going to trivialize them because they're things that I care passionately about, which is the growing inequality, police brutality, gun violence, ballot access restrictions, the whole reproductive choice debate. Well, we started seeing corporations speak out on those things. And those things are things where there's often a societal divide, right? 50-50 other things. And what you start to see is people, and this is not actually historically new, but we're going, every generation kind of relives history. People applaud corporations when they orient themselves politically in a direction that they favor. And then they criticize corporations when their leaders take positions that they don't favor. And two people of very polar, you know, you've got an audience that's learned it, Ralph Nader and Milton Friedman. If you go back in the day, you know, in the 1970s, where there was some great music and then there was disco, some disco is good. I mean, you can't slight the Bee Gees' Saturday Night Fever album or some of it, but others of it is truly horrific. The song Ring My Bell has rung my bell in a horrible way for 40 years or so. But if you go back to then, both Milton Friedman would argue corporations didn't have the legitimacy to use other people's money, right? Corporate leaders use other people's money that they didn't invest for this, for their own ends. And that's not good for society, and they should stick to their knitting. Ralph Nader had exactly the same concerns, but coming from the left, saying, you know, and business leaders are most likely to be conservatives and people on the right, and we don't want them acting on society. And we're at that moment again, where there's this kind of contradiction, where I'm a person of the left. I was never scared by Ronald Reagan out of the term liberal. And, you know, progressive, remember why progressive is used now, Evan? It was really used because when people were starting to get like, feel like it get confident again to be not a moderate, progressive was more associated with Teddy Roosevelt. And so it was seen as a way to, like, I couldn't call myself a liberal, but maybe I call myself a progressive. So I just never got scared out of it. I'm a Roosevelt, MLK liberal, don't apologize for it kind of person. So I come from the left, but I also recognize that not everybody comes from the left. That corporate leaders are not elected because of their political capabilities. They actually don't really have any. And there's no reason to presume that the workforce at any company has a monolithic political view, or that stockholders do. And actually, part of the tradition of being a person of the left is you actually respect diversity, good faith diversity of opinion. You suspect any kind of overarching orthodoxy where someone, you know, is trying to kind of implement their own totalitarian vision using their power. And so it gets uncomfortable if a space in society where that everybody kind of has to share because you have to make a living, if that becomes politicized and where people go to work and they feel like they kind of have to bend to a company orthodoxy, that's uncomfortable. And then if you think about it, is why do we think corporate leaders are representative of the common person? And corporations, by their nature, we created them, Evan, right? You're a corporate law scholar. We created them to create wealth. But they're different. They're not human beings. They can't be sentenced to death, really. They have perpetual existence. They have all kinds of tax advantages. And they pool our wealth. And so they're larger, and they really can spend more than us. And so do we really want them tilting a system that was made for us? And I think what we're seeing is people lining up and in very contradictory ways, where my friends, the Democrats, are saying, you know, corporations shouldn't be spending in politics, but they should boycott for political reasons states, right? They should. Well, that's also very coercive, but the Republicans are in the opposite place. Let them spend as much money as possible. Give us the money, but just shut up. And so part of why I wrote about this is I don't think it's very productive, actually, to just call out as illegitimate corporate behavior that's only illegitimate in your mind because the policy position the corporation has taken is different than yours, while applauding corporations who speak out when you like what they say. I don't think that helps business leaders. I think it catches business leaders in the middle of an impossible situation. And I was trying to come up with an approach and that is more workable, and that I honestly think is more true to the freedom we ought to have as individuals to have our own beliefs, and for human beings rather than abstract corporations that we truly don't invest in for political reasons to be driving our politics.
Yeah, and it's really interesting because you also summarize the current debate and you put on the one end the stockholder primacy versus the stakeholder governance model. Of course, you've already described this is a long debate. I mean, we can go back to the 1930s, Dodd and Burley, the 1970s with Friedman. It's just a rehashed debate. I suppose after the Business Roundtable's restatement in 2019, it's all become new in the purpose. But what's interesting is you come from the corporate law perspective of Delaware. And so you propose some guardrails. And what should the role of a director of a Delaware company do, right? Does the board have the legitimacy towards, you know, setting these standards? What about stockholders? And you propose kind of a new structure, which is, I think, very enlightening.
Yeah, I mean, what I think is that what sort of reduces the right left wing tensions is to think about corporate citizenship this way. Do we believe companies should make money the right way? And what I mean by the right way is this: when you make that product or service, do the people who work for you and who are most important to creating that, do they get a respectful, safe place to come to work where people of diverse backgrounds, of any color, of good faith, can come together and labor productively in a nice workplace, and where they get paid wages and benefits that are quality and that allow them to provide for themselves and a better life for their children. I think when you look at Republican and Democratic views on whether corporations should value their workers, treat workers better, you'll see a convergence. Mm-hmm. Should those products and services that the corporation sells make the customers' lives better off? Shouldn't they be safe? Shouldn't they be non-fraudulent? There's no left-right divide about that. When a corporation has a facility in the community, shouldn't it be kept up? Shouldn't the corporation pay its share of local taxes? Shouldn't the corporation contribute to the local charities? I think everybody agrees with that. Do we want corporations to pollute the environment in the communities where they operate? Absolutely not. Part of our corrosive debate, people say, well, what about climate change? Well, that's because we've had such a corrosive debate that to bring back Orwell again, Orwellian, you know, that's a word he was never Orwellian. He was for plain speak. Part of what I said in the article, as you know, Evan, is polls of people who hunt and fish, right? Many of them are Republicans, right? Republicans are proud of the support they get from, you know, they call it, you know, from sports people. Polls of them overwhelmingly favor strong environmental regulation to keep corporations from polluting the waters in which they fish and the places where they fish, right? So if you think about those things that I just talked about, those are what means is sure seek profit. But in seeking profit, make sure you're not externalizing the cost of what you're doing to others. To quote Hippocrates, right? Do no harm. First thing, do no harm, right? Is make money without doing harm. And I commend everybody who listens to this to read the work of Professors Hart and Zangalis, who is very much in the same spirit as me, talking about that, Evan, about how do you look at really investor welfare? And so what the paper does is sort of say, you think about what's most important to a corporation being good to society. Isn't it how it treats others in doing its business? And isn't that the most contribution it can make, is to set those kinds of high standards? And that's also what it controls. And when they do that, can't they leave the external issues largely to the people who should have them? Like, which is, we actually value our workers' freedom. They should decide these issues. Our customers should decide these. We don't want to be a red or blue company. We want to be a company that's a good corporate citizen, and we welcome everyone of good faith to work for us, to be a customer with us. We do have values, like we don't believe in discrimination, and we're going to model that in our own workforce. We're going to make sure that our workers have access to health care. If we feel that our workers are not having access to it, we're going to help them travel. But what we're not going to do is to spend our time really having a company orthodoxy, because we actually think freedom, diversity of thought, and freedom are really important to our nation, and we have to respect that. And that's sort of what I'm saying. And I think that line, and I also think we let corporate leaders off the hook, Evan. When we give them credit for a situational New York Times op-ed, or they sign on the big letter, by the way, why can't they pay for it themselves with their CEOs? They have the corporation pay. Is that as important as how they treat their workers every day? And they control how they treat their workers. They control their environmental practices. They control their, and it's difficult enough to be a good business because things go wrong, that I'm not sure it's terribly productive to actually put pressure on the business community to do the things that they're really not legitimately capable of doing and they're not legitimately elected to do. And I'm not sure it doesn't distract from holding them accountable for the things that they should be focusing on and where they do have the most impact on people's lives and on the future of our planet.
So one of the things that I want to talk to you about is what's the role of the board in approving these policies? And you delve into political spending, for example, and you say, look, maybe we should have supermajority voting to approve these spendings. Why should the CEO, for example, make this decision? Let's talk about the role of the board and stockholders. And are you proposing something that is different that should be applied to curtail this political environment where, you know, maybe we can talk about anti-ESG, but maybe that's a bit later.
No, and I actually think that's what I think is so important about this is that both the left and the right, as I point out, are concerned about this legitimacy problem, and they should be. We both know, right, for audience, one of the tools that corporate law has used, corporate law is a tool, and it is drawn, if you look at Professor Bowie's scholarship from Harvard, the corporate law statutes in this country drew on the colonial charters, the state governments, and he drew on the tradition, the use of a blend of direct democratic tools, which is, you know, what are the things that are so important to have in right where you need the electorate to vote? And so in states, sometimes you have to have, you know, sometimes there are referendums or their constitutional amendments are voted on by the electorate. In corporate law, the corporate charter has to be approved and amendments to it to be approved by the stockholders. A merger has to be approved by the stockholders because it's seen Republican democracy may not be enough then. And then you combine it with representativeness, right? With the business judgment rule isn't to disrespect the judgments of anyone. It's to respect the judgments of people you get a chance to elect. And so, and corporate law has often policed, as you know, conflict transactions more. And there's a lot of evidence. It's like there is no alignment between a CEO's political beliefs necessarily and the stockholder base. And the Center for Political Responsibility has done great work on this. It just shows how tilted public company spending is in the political process towards in a way that doesn't skew with our politics. In fact, the Democratic Party and independents both have larger memberships than the Republican Party. But most public company political spending goes overwhelmingly to Republicans and Republican interest groups. I'm not against Republicans competing. I believe in the political process. I don't believe corporate wealth should tilt it. And so what I kind of propose is on two levels. And there's another thing that is rooted to get at both points. There's a reason for boards of directors, and they're supposed to oversee management. And there's a reason why you have a group, and that's to have different voices and different perspectives shape policy. It doesn't mean that the resulting policy, right, Evan, will be perfect, but it does mean that there's a chance for others to be heard. And we have emphasized sitting independent board majorities for this reason. So I basically say use these traditional tools. And on the stockholder front, one of the most venerable people, and he's no longer with us, but a real gentleman, an old school gentleman in the best of senses, was a great American called Jack Bogle. And I got to meet Mr. Bogle, and I actually got to know him a little bit. And I was very flattered. He read my work. And he, when Citizens United came out, he proposed, and it's something I very much support. He said, no public company should engage in political spending unless it's under a plan approved by 75% of the stockholders. And he's proposed that supermajority, Evan, for this simple, inarguable reason. He knew that no one invested with Vanguard as an expression of their political views, that under 401k, most people have to invest. To save for college for your kid, you have to invest under 529. You have to invest in mutual funds. He knew that Vanguard didn't have anybody's money because Vanguard was going to invest in companies for political reasons. And he thought it was illegitimate for people to use other people's power and capital in a way that had no connection to their investments. And so he thought that sensibly that there ought to be a very high supermajority that showed basically a consensus bipartisan support of the investors for anything. Because the U.S. Supreme Court constitutionalized in a very unhistorical way, I read Citizens United as sort of a white whale of mine for those of you who know the literary inspiration for America's biggest coffee chain, Moby Dick. Starbuck was the character, and he was the first mate in Moby Dick. I've written a lot about Citizen China. The United States Supreme Court just took out of Congress's hands the ability to fix this. Like institutional investors made classified boards, Evan, a thing of the past, they could very quickly have an effect on this. Boards of directors, CEOs have found, to their surprise, when they take some of these social issues to boards, they hear things that they may not have thought of. I think it legitimizes if a company's going to take an external position, it shouldn't be just the CEO. The entire board of directors should have to stand behind it. We're focusing rightly on diversity of functional skills and experience with boards, but also of diversity of perspective in terms of increasing gender. And frankly, finally, institutional investors have been focused on racial inequality. It was a big blind spot for a long time. But at least if the company's going to take an external position, the board of directors on a policy issue should think about that. And they should also think about, okay, if we're going to take a position on this, we better look at our political spending. And if we've been giving to the people who passed the law that we're now objecting to, we better be honest and say, we gave to these people in the past, we're stopping this. Because along with illegitimacy, Evan, has become this hypocrisy factor, which is situationally speaking out on an issue, mm-hmm. and then having given tens of millions. And I'm not exaggerating. If you look at the data, and again, I commend the Center for Political Responsibility's work on this, tens of millions to the political committees that have passed the same laws that have been behind them that you're now condemning. Think about how that makes a business look. You don't get credibility with anybody because you're not really being true to what you're saying. And part of my view, I think ideally they should just say, we leave politics to others and at best give through a pack where the only people who give are management. Because by the way, Evan, there was a real world test about stockholders and whether they wanted to give money. Corporate PACs have long been able to raise unlimited sums from corporate stockholders. They never asked for them because they'd be laughed at. Can you imagine your 401k? Can you imagine getting your letter from Fidelity saying, you know, Professor, we would like to put in, we'd like at Fidelity, we'd like to authorize, you know, contributions on the PAC on your behalf from the Fidelity Contra Fund, a fund that I'm an investor.
Right.
Could we do that? We'd like to take, you know, give $500 to each PAC in the S&P 500 or to select PACs. You would be like, I'm not investing with Fidelity anymore, right? Can you imagine a dear ExxonMobil stockholder or Walmart stockholder or Apple stockholder? Right. We know you invest in us because you love us. Could you send us your annual $1,000 to our corporate PAC? There would immediately be an activist campaign saying the CEO, to get back to Chancery, the CEO needs to be taken to the Delaware Court of Chancery and have a guardian of his person because he's not oriented to time and place. But this is actually what goes on if a big company gives money and the boards of directors often are not involved. And lobbyists for the companies tell them this is the important people in these state houses. The important people are the people who regulate you. It's not contributions based generally on whether the corporation believes in those person's beliefs. It's whether the person actually has regulatory power over them. And that leads to the corporation speaking outside both sides of its mouth. And there's a dirty little secret. It's not actually a dirty little secret because I think business people openly admit it. They didn't like Citizens United. They like the old rules, Evan. And you know why? Because if you can't say yes, no one asks. And when corporations were not allowed to use their treasury funds, they weren't subjected to pressure from politicians and political committees to give money. Now that they're legally authorized to do that, then the people who regulate them and who have power over them come and ask for money. And so this is not good for investors. It's not appropriate. It's not legitimate. And it could be shut down if the institutional investment community would get together and provide leadership in this area. And frankly, if some CEOs would get themselves out of the middle by taking what I think would be a very popular step of saying, our corporation ain't doing this anymore. We're done with this. It's a distraction. It's not fair. And we understand that's not why we have people's money. And on the issue I was talking about right-left divide, one thing where there's a supermajority of the American people in favor of the majority of Republicans, majority of Democrats, majority of independents, all believe corporations should not be engaging in political spending. So here's the something about a broken system. The problem is that the political people, they're addicted to the money trough. So this is where, if you're going to shut this down, a combination of institutional investor leadership and business leadership is really important. I would love to see my friend Lucian Bebchuk, for example, who is my dear friend, I love him, and who spent a lot of time putting ballot initiatives to get rid of classified boards. I think he could do a lot more good for the world if he would push proposals in this area of political spending. And Evan, I think you should do a program specifically calling on Lucian and Rob Jackson and Frank Partnoy to align and make that happen. That's my challenge of this program to some of your corporate law colleagues.
Okay. We'll definitely try. And obviously, they've all written eloquently about some of these issues.
And that's why I said, yeah, I think this is perfect. I love them. Yeah. And guys, this is my plea to you to collect your talents on behalf of the American people and to make this happen.
So let me ask you a question, which is related to the institutional investors. And obviously, this is a big area of interest in corporate governance. And over the last 20, 30, 40 years, they've acquired much more relevance in corporate governance. And a lot of them are saying, in fact, Jack Bogle famously said, you know, they're getting so big that at some point, it's they're going to control the majority of corporations in America. And is it good that you have few people that have this power? And how do you see that constraint happening? And at some level, you know, Larry Fink at BlackRock is now under pressure, and they are doing, they're passing through voting shares, and they feel some pressure, and maybe the whole political spectrum and, you know, this anti-ESG is framed in a way that, hey, it's these big asset managers like BlackRock that are mandating what they don't win in the ballot through their agenda of corporate governance at doing things, and we think this is bad. And now we see states that are divesting, and we have a much bigger problem in our hands in, you know, Florida and Texas and Louisiana and other states. So how do you think about the question of institutional investors' involvement in corporate governance in this realm?
I mean, this is really complex. I actually have applauded, and I continue to applaud, that the index funds are finally recognizing that when you hold the investments of people who are not going to sell, they're therefore, they don't care about quarterly earnings. They care about sustainable growth. They're invested not in one company, so they don't want one company like an Enron or a WorldCom or an opioid manufacturer making profits at the expenses, unfair profits at the expense of other people in the industry, or externalizing costs because you bear those costs. And if the fraud gets caught out, you know when the index funds sold Enron, Evan?
Did they?
Oh, sure, they sell it. You know when they sell
when?
It? When it goes to zero and it goes out of the index. Mm-hmm. That's when they sell it. So focusing on companies making money the right way, to get back to my theme, making money the right way without externalizing costs, that's what we want, right? If the S&P 500 all focus, that means that they're they're going to compete on quality and innovation. That's what we want. That is going to create the most growth for us as an investor. And by the way, that is our economic portfolio. We want them to create quality jobs, right? Because for everyone except the top 1%, everyone, even the top 5%, except for the top 1%, more of your money comes from your access to a quality job than from your savings. What you get to save depends on your job. Your portfolio also is, you've heard of the 60-40 portfolio, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
That's debt. There's a lot of evidence that risks for equity shift costs to debt holders. Well, if you are a bondholder, which you're going to be if you're a retiree, or your as your kid's portfolio, right? When your kid gets closer to college, your 529 starts being more in bonds. You kind of want those bonds to be repaid. And you pay taxes. So corporate externalities come into your taxes. So thinking, having investors, having index funds actually think like they're investors is a good thing. What's unfortunate is gotten confused is corporations speaking out about controversial political issues has now rebounded against some of the index investors. Because we're a country where the political debate has become so corrosive that things like vaccines have become politicized, that the climate debate has somehow gotten into this. I'm hoping it's going to get orderly. There is no way for an institutional investor to be a responsible fiduciary without considering climate risk if you're invested as they are in certain industries. For example, I'm not going to name the name of the company we represent, but I was on a call with the general counsel, and she was very concerned about this. They're a public company. They're in indexes. What about this investment? I said, honestly, I can't imagine how you as a company would not have a fiduciary duty to make this front and center. Because you know what the business was, Evan? A reinsurer of storm and weather incidents. I don't think that these stated treasurers are really thinking about that. And the fact that there are many businesses for, you know, or if you own hotels that are, for example, in regions prone to flooding, I think it's more a symptom of the corroded debate. And by my article, what I'm trying to do is ameliorate that debate, which is institutional investors say, we are focused on making sure our companies make money the right way. That's what's important to our investors. And that's why we're doing this. We're actually not focusing on external issues, which are matters of public policy. And honestly, I think it would help the institutional investors if they would actually shut down the political spending, then the ground for difference starts narrowing. I don't like the fact that the institutions may be trying to escape responsibility by sort of saying, okay, we're just going to pass through the voting. I'm an index investor because that's rational. And I don't want to outguess the stock market, but it means my portfolio has 500 to 3,000 companies in it. I don't want to vote. Mm-hmm. Now, if we go back to the 1970s before, if we go back to where the Wall Street rule was the rule, so that none of the institutions have to vote unless they believe that it's in their fiduciary interest to vote. And so they'll vote on elections and they'll vote on mergers, but they're not going to be part of the model UN that the activist community and the public pension funds have created. And so inertia is going to be on the side of the company in the sense that you're invested in the company because you like the company. If you don't like the company, you'll sell. If somebody wants to change company policy, they have to galvanize a majority to really come out for it. If we want to change back to that rule, I'm okay with that. And to also allow brokers to vote on behalf of their clients, many of whom relied on their brokers for that because they picked those companies and they liked them. If we want to go back to those rules, that's fine. But pass-through voting under the current system is no answer. The stuck-in, sustainably focused investor, i.e. the most American investors, are just not going to be heard. And activists and special interest investors are going to have their voice amplified. That's not okay. And this industry has been federally subsidized. As we're speaking, our money and money from our fellow workers is going into their coffers because we don't get to buy and sell individual stocks. I don't know about your 401k plan. Ain't my how mine has ever worked. We get to pick from mutual funds and we give money to them and they manage it until, and I can't take the money out and for another 4 months. I just turned 59 without a tax penalty. You got many years to go, and it's going to be in that industry. And so with, as Adolf Burley taught, with power should come responsibility. And I actually applaud them for doing better in terms of trying to align their corporate governance policies with that of a sustainable investor and to hold accountable companies accountable for making money the right way. I think they still have a long way to go in doing that better. I think there are blind spots like the political spending, but I think it is totally wrong to suggest that, frankly, that they're captive of any big political interest. I think for a long time they've had a blind spot about worker treatment, and that's because they are, frankly, old school investors, and they've actually pushed a lot of the policies that have hurt workers by making companies more subject to the influence of themselves and of the stock market. And so, you know, they're not a left-wing conspiracy. And I think it would really be ridiculous to actually suggest that companies like reinsurers or hotel chains can't consider an objective business risk. It's actually their duty to do it. And, and this is important, I do understand that when corporations get out of their lane and when they're perceived as taking, you know, positions on issues on which society is closely divided, that there's a consequence to that. And I think that's what you're really seeing. And I think it has a lot less to do with BlackRock, you know, in particular, or Vanguard or State Street, than the overall corrosive, you know, divide that we have in the country.
Okay. Leo, we could be talking for hours on governance, but I'm going to...
Yes, and I'm sorry. I'm not good at short answers, Evan. But I think one of the problems in our country, though, is, you know, if you think about what passes for public discourse, I think many people would be shocked, for example, to watch a 30-minute broadcast of CBS or NBC News in 1970 or even 1985, and to recognize how much longer just the evening news stories were and how much more serious.
Yeah, we can keep going. I'm happy. I'm just
no, I'm just saying that it's an interesting thing in our discourse. And one of the problems with this stuff is that it's serious, but then when it's done in a cartoonish nature, that lore rather than facts become the driver. And, you know, climate is a great example of that, which is, you know, one group that I don't think would characteristically be called a big part of the vanguard of the left. And another group that is traditionally kind of regarded as, you know, not really all that partisan. If you put them together, right, the first group of actuaries. Actuaries overwhelmingly believe that human conduct is creating climate change, which has a serious effect on the environment and on things like weather risks and business. So do scientists. So when we're in a situation where we're really trying to pretend that something doesn't exist. And when groups who were traditionally aligned with fact-based things, and frankly, in the form of actuaries, would actually be probably people more likely to be on the right wing than the left wing, when they all believe in something, and then there's a pushback against it, it may be because we have a larger, deeper problem as a country in terms of coming together around common values. And Evan, what I'm trying to say is I think that Thanksgiving dinner behavior needs to be where we are on the business community, which is we have values. People of good faith come to that table. We try to come productively and have that dinner. We try to treat each other with respect. We try to remember that there are probably parts of each of us that we don't all admire. I'm trying to remember that we ourselves are imperfect. But we want to have that table be a place we can come and value. Well, we have to go to work. And as Professor Elizabeth Anderson, the great philosopher of Michigan, points out, most of us spend more of our working day with people at work and more of our lives awaking with people at work than we do with our family. And so we don't really want to have a situation where we go someplace and we're not welcome. But what comes with being welcome ourselves is recognizing that people of good faith can believe different things from yourself. They can look different from you. And that the real magic comes when people who are different come together for a common purpose, learn more about each other's humanity, get the job done, and feel good about it. And that we lose an awful lot if we start turning the business space into a divided one where, you know, you have to either just basically tolerate intolerance in order to make your living, or we start dividing up businesses in sort of monolithic and boring ways that model some current generation of corporate leadership.
Yeah. So let's move into the rapid fire questions. I'm really curious on what are the 1, 2, 3 books that have greatly influenced your life?
I will say that Down and Out in London and Paris, Road to Wigan Pier by George Orwell were hugely influential to me and putting a human face on, you know, the problems of modern society and capitalism. I'd actually say my parents gave me books called, like, simple books when I was 4 and 5 called, like, Meet Martin Luther King. There was books like Meet Franklin Roosevelt that animated me, you know, towards sort of understanding the larger mission of our society.
How old were you then?
Those were like very short books, like 4 and 5. I started reading Orwell when I was around 10, and I think I subscribed to the New Republic. And I used to subscribe to both the New Republic and the National Review when I was a kid, just so I would learn from both sides. And I also love literature. So I'm not sure there's any, particular book, but I read constantly sort of novels and history. But Orwell, extremely important to me, and and his writings as really a prototypical social democrat.
And you mentioned Moby Dick, so that's a book that people.
Yeah, so, and I have read, just an amazing book. And I mean, like, if you read, like, I would urge for all of you, if you haven't read The Scarlet Letter as an adult, totally different. You got to, Evan, it's one of the real problems in life is that people give literature, they give books at the wrong cycle. And, you can read something and I try to read Moby Dick, although I told my friends at the SEC, I try to read it every 5 years, that the SEC has put together so many releases last summer that I had to put aside rereading Moby Dick. But I love a lot of literature and my wife, is kind of tired of how many books I have. And
Yeah, that tends to happen to me too. I order more books than I can read, but I think that's a good thing, and Japanese have a word for that, so it's good. Who were your mentors, and what did you learn from them?
I've been so lucky in my mentors. I've had I clerked for two judges. I mean, the society changes. Both the judges I clerked for were Republican appointees, and you would never know whether they were Republican or Democrat because that was not the way things were. So I've learned a ton from them. I lost one person we talked about, Skadden Wilmington. Rod Ward, my mentor, taught me the right way to practice law and to win cases on the merits, to be good to your people on the other side of the V. Senator Tom Carper, who amazing person, and his chief of staff, Ed Friel, and, you know, my friend Jeff Bullock. I mean, I've learned from so many people, but Tom Carper is a person who's such an old school, like what it really means to be an elected leader, not about himself, not about microphones, about achievement. I mean, that a person who got a hydrofluorocarbon phase out done during the Trump administration, working with the Business Roundtable for many years and the Environmental Defense Fund. You wouldn't think of getting that done, right? And he had the credibility because he works across party lines. He was incredibly crucial to getting the infrastructure bill. He's done amazing things for our state. He served, was a reconnaissance commander of P-3 planes in the Vietnam era and served as a reserve officer. You know, I can tell you quirky things about Tom, but what I'd say is like a model of public service. And so I've been so lucky with and my colleagues on Chancery and, you know, like somebody and I was friends with Chancellor Allen. I came to Wachtell Lipton in many ways because of people here, but especially Marty Lipton, who, you know, he studied with Adolph Burley, Evan. Marty was going to be an academic and he sort of loved practice. So, you know, Marty he's taught continuously at NYU and, you know, basically a deeply committed New Dealer to his community. And as you know, the things he's written, if you think about his writing, his article about takeover bids in the boardroom, and if you think about he was an advocate of stakeholder capitalism, right, this entire time. So I've just been very fortunate to work with a diverse, you know, and I taught with Bob Clark and Michael Wachter, each of them for almost a generation. You talk about two enormously wonderful scholars and teachers. So, I mean, my life has been blessed. And, you know, some of my mentors are like my wife, is the most important career in our family. She was a occupational therapist at an internationally regarded children's hospital for our whole lives together. And she talked, you know, she treats kids with brain cancer, with cerebral palsy, with the paraplegics, with serious burns, patients that she's, you know, she's lost so many patients, the heartbreak, but to see the ones, you know, who she treated 25 years ago, they call her on special events and are part of her lives. That, you know, that puts in perspective, you know, if I ever thought I was impressive being a judge or, you know, running things, when the people do that kind of thing. And so I've just had a lot of folks who have modeled what I think is exemplary behavior. And I can't help to have ever lived up to them, but I hope to have taken something from them.
Yeah, no, it's amazing. And are there any quotes you think of often or live your life by?
Yeah, there's a few. I'm a big music fan. And so Elvis Costello, for example, Clown Time is Over, is a great song, and it comes to mind, came to mind during a certain deal break dispute last fall, which I won't really talk about more, but it was pretty spring that it was definitely important for Clown Time to be over there. Judge Gary, I don't know how, you know, whether people, Judge Gary was a wonderful guy. This was his advice to all new judges and all new lawyers. Be yourself, unless, of course, yourself is an asshole, in which case, be someone else. And so, Evan, that comes to mind, and I think we all fail to live up to it, but I think it's kind of a way of really kind of grounding yourself. And for something as lawyers, you know, Walt Stapleton taught me, he said, Leo, you know, the thing will come to mind, you'll get frustrated as a judge. And what I always learned as a trial judge is when the words, I'm going to cut through this, come to mind, that when those words come to mind, before you say them, you step back and think about what you're doing and exhale and realize that your impatience and frustration might actually just be leading you to take a shortcut that's inequitable, and that's actually going to be a long road to heartache. And so there's a couple of them. I mean, I'm a music freak. So, I mean, I constantly have songs, particularly of like James Taylor or Paul McCartney or, you know, Sam Cooke in my head. And, but those are a few of the quotes. And unfortunately, in the law, it is more things like clown time is over that sometimes come to mind than some of the more edifying things.
Right. So, and what is an unusual habit or an absurd thing that you love?
Well, it kind of is related to lyrics. My wife and kids have had to tolerate. I have stuck in my head pretty much every pop song of the 1970s. You know, you grew up, you're like, life is stuck in two decades. So for me, it's like the 1970s and the 90s. And I was like, remember like things in 1997, because I was working for Governor Carper when it's 2007. But the 70s were, the worst songs were so bad that they were wonderful. Like, no, I mean, they're just so bad. Like, there's this song, I've been to paradise, but I've never been to me. It's so bad. I encourage all of you to just do it. Or like, I mean, I the night Chicago died. And so one of the things that I do is I can make up sort of spontaneous variations, usually inappropriate. I told my kid, my dad once, he's one of my younger son is, both my sons are funny. My younger son is sort of like me. And so my father once said to him, Ben, that's not funny. And I said, Dad, you'd have more credibility if you said what was really true, because it was frickin' funny. It was inappropriate. So I'm able to usually take a song and twist it in some inappropriate but modestly humorous and on point to whatever context we are way. So that is kind of a quirky thing for me. And
that's great.
You know, and there are most lyrics that I know, like the lyrics to the song, you know, the Joker. I mean, there's not many songs where people speak from the pompousness of love, for example.
And I'm sure they come up at the exact wrong times where you want to say them most.
Yeah. You know, it's the problem is ear, like those earworms. It's really bad. Like I was at a conference and, you know, someone insisted during this kind of, like they had their playlist on a bus and we were stuck on this bus and they insisted on playing and they played really loud Helen Reddy's I Am Woman. Now, both my grandmothers work, my mom worked, my wife works. I'm a big supporter of women's rights. Just not my song. But for 3 weeks when I went to bed, like 3 o'clock in the morning, you know, I was hearing Helen roar. I am woman, hear me roar. And you know, I am too ignore. And it, you know, and now if you get like that way where you just cannot, I had a Jim Croce song that just would not leave me. Unfortunately, my hairline left me, but those songs. Nice.
Okay. Well, final question, which living person do you most admire?
I mentioned, I mean, I can't, it's really hard to put it that way. No, because like in public, like I really do mean it, that like our senator, our senior senator is just an exemplary model of what it means to play a role in the way that you should. But I think the people that I most admire are actually the people like my wife, the people who do the hardest jobs that are most important to people and where there really isn't public glory. And that's not why they do it. They do it because they care. And they do it often, you know, we don't treat those people that well in society. When you think about how we treated the people who work in hospitals during COVID, I mean, they're the ones who put them in risk. And, you know, that's why, for example, I feel like one of the basic things that we've lost is the reason the reason you get a vaccine is not about you. It's a simple thing that you owe to others. And I, so I think the people I most admire are the people who continue to put themselves at risk. You know, even when the people they're treating had an actual inability to reduce their own exposure and to protect other people and didn't. And I think we see that with people every day. And I understand, like there are problems, for example, with policing in this country, no doubt about it.
Yeah.
But if you know police officers, and I have had the privilege to know a lot of them, you know, most of them just deeply care and are committed to the community. And sometimes if the worst comes out of them, it's because of the difficulties of their job. And so the people, you know, I think that it's the unsung who do the things that are most essential to a caring community that I think we should most admire. And I think that we don't really do a particularly good job in the society of recognizing them.
Well, on that note, Leo, I think that was great. Thank you so much for your time and for talking to us about governance and about society and at large and these issues that are now imposing into politics and societal issues and corporate governance. So it's great to talk to you. Thank you for doing this. It's a great 100th episode, and I look forward to seeing you soon.
Yeah, and Evan, it's been an honor to be with you, and I thank you for your time, and I thank you for what you're doing with the podcast and providing people with diverse views on these important issues. So take care, my friend.
Thank you for tuning in to the Boardroom Governance Podcast. If you like what you heard, please consider subscribing, leaving a review, or sharing this podcast on social media. You can also contribute as a patron on the link patreon.com/boardroomgovernancepod. You can check out all the details related to this podcast at the website boardroom-governance.com, and please feel free to subscribe to the Boardroom Governance newsletter at evanepstein.substack.com.